We're going to be looking in content-wise at the wedding ceremony, the liturgical part of the wedding. We're not going to be dwelling a lot of time on the Sheva Brachot, but we are going to start with the Sheva Brachot, or what's known as the Sheva Brachot. You'll see there's not Sheva of them. And what I'm asking you to do is bracket your wedding Dvar Torah. we're gonna open it up as if we've never seen it before, if that's at all possible. Okay, so that's the we save this to the end because you wouldn't on Sunday night, forget it. No way you could do this. But now you can totally do this, bracketing your own wedding Dvar Torah. We're gonna look at the text and see what speaks to us anew. Okay, that's our goal for now. So I'm going to headline to you my theory that I want to put out, and then we're going to see it in the texts themselves, and you can push back and tell me that's not what you see. But I just want to sort of give you the main idea methodologically, and then we're going to sort of explore it together as we make our way through. So here's the main idea. My main idea on the Sheva Brachot, or the wedding, the sort of Nisuin ceremony, is that there is a master narrative, but also a sub-narrative. Okay? The master narrative is not going to be surprising. And as we see the content of the brachot that I brought to you from their original context in Ketubot, my argument is that, at least for part of the brachot, the master narrative of the wedding ceremony is Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve are the models that we're stepping into. And you can see that through the language that's used in the brachot as they're brought here in Ketubot. But I want to argue that there's not only one narrative that's showing up in the wedding ceremony itself. There's also a sub-narrative. And my theory on the narratives is, when there's a master narrative and a sub-narrative, they are meant to actually be in that hierarchical relationship. That is to say, I'm not saying that it's not about Adam and Eve. I am saying that it is about Adam and Eve, but it's not only about Adam and Eve. There's another possibility that you can hold at the same time. And the other narrative that I'm seeing here is the narrative of the wedding of Boaz and Ruth. And the way in which we're going to try to develop this, I have some evidence that I'd like to bring to bear, but the sort of where we're going to end up at the end, my hope is that we'll be able to hold both of these narratives together, even though one is frontline and one takes a back seat. But a back seat is different from doesn't exist. Okay? Now, there is some agenda here, but only a mild agenda. The mild agenda is sometimes the story of Adam and Eve doesn't work for everybody. Okay? And there are many, many people for whom it does work, but for some people it doesn't work. I'm not saying that the sub-narrative is meant to undermine the master narrative entirely, but it is different. And I think that's significant. That is to say, the fact that there are more than one models of marriage, and this is not something that was like invented in 2007. I'm saying this is already hanging out there in the Talmud. That is opening up the possibility that you could never contain wedding experiences in only one narrative. You need at least more than one narrative. And you could say there's even more than Boaz and Ruth and Adam and Chava. There's others as well. But I want to at least bring to the surface the sub-narrative of Boaz and Ruth and play that out. Okay? Are we with me on sort of where we're going and the main idea of the two narratives of the wedding ceremony? Good? Okay. So let's just see the master narrative as it exists here. If you turn to page one in Ketubot. So what's interesting about the Sheva Brachot as they appear, and some of us looked at this a few years ago, the rabbinic intensive inside in the Gemara, but what's interesting about the Sheva Brachot is, first of all, they're not called Sheva Brachot. The main reason is there aren't seven of them. There are, if you count them, how many do you see? I number them for you. Six. There's six, okay? And not only are there six brachot, which bracha is missing? Bori Pri Agafen. Okay, so the Bori Pri Agafen, which you may remember, under the chuppah you start with, and at Birkat HaMazon you end with, which is already a telltale sign that if bracha's moving around, it wasn't core to the order there. But that the whole cycle of brachot isn't called Sheva Brachot until after the close of the Talmud in the Gaonic text, where they bring that Bori Pri Agafen as part of the number, and then they call it Sheva Brachot as a result. But in the story, in the Gemara, in Ketubot, you may remember this as well, is that not only are there six Brachot, not seven, but then there's a debate about actually are they saying six at all? Because you have other rabbis who are coming and saying, oh, I'm going to bless five Brachot. I'm going to bless four Brachot. And there was actually a tradition that was said in there's a Gaonic work called the Chilukim, the differences between Eretz Yisrael and Bavel. And in these two communities, as they number out all the differences, one of the differences that they enumerate is Bavel, the people who are descended from the sort of Babylonian Gaonim, they say Sheva Brachot, because at that time they already have Bori Pri HaGafen. And in Eretz Yisrael, they say Shalosh. Okay? So there was another tradition in Eretz Yisrael lands after the close of the Talmud to only say three brachot at this point that we would call Sheva Brachot. And as you'll notice, the brachot that are listed in the Talmud here, they come out of the mouth of Rav Yehuda, who is hanging out where? Just by his name? In Bavel, right? Okay, if he's called Rav, he's in Bavel. Okay, so Rav Yehuda is giving you the liturgy here, but it's a Babylonian liturgy. So there's already, by the time of the Talmud, there's a parallel Eretz Yisrael version of this, which we don't have. Various scholars have tried to reconstruct. And you could do your own game, by the way, if you're just going to like eyeball it. If you had to pick three out of the six here, which three would you pick to be the Eretz Yisrael parallel for the brachot that you would say at a wedding? And why?
Six.
Okay, number six you would want to have because why?
Because of the joy of being back in the Holy Land.
Yeah.
Coming back together again into the Eretz.
Okay, so six. Okay, so you want to put six? Any other votes for any other ones? The core ones?
Four
because?
Children.
Misameach Tzion Bivanei, you got children. Okay, yeah. Four, six. Anyone else?
Can I just ask a clarification?
Yeah.
In addition to Kiddush?
In addition to Kiddush?
No.
In Eretz Yisrael, wasn't clear if they were saying Bori Pri HaGafen, but let's leave Bori Pri HaGafen off to the side. So three in addition, or maybe three in total, but not including Bori Pri HaGafen. So we got four, we got six. Yeah, Lawrence?
Five, because it's also a location, right? Just like Jerusalem is, now it's talking about Gan Eden, and you know, Jerusalem is now the new Gan Eden.
Okay, great. So four, five, and six is the argument of Avigdor Shinan. If you've ever seen his Sidur Avichai that he published a few years ago, he says, but yep, these are basically the main themes. Anyone want to venture another guess of which of the three that you would hold on to?
Three.
As the core? Why three?
Shalom Elohim.
Okay, good. Which takes you back to?
Creation.
The creation Adam and Chava story. Yeah. And then which ones are you knocking out?
That's hard. One and two.
One and two. Why one?
Well, you almost don't need one and two if you have three.
Ah, why?
Because creation is encapsulated in number three.
Good, right? Look at number three. What's the chatima of number three? Yotzer Adam, same as
two.
Number two, yeah. Right? And what about number one? Pretty darn close,
yeah.
Right? Bara and Yatzar and Hakol instead of Adam. But you could see how, all right, so maybe one, two, and three, you could really collapse it into just one of those three. Any other ones you would collapse? Redundant?
I would collapse three into six.
Three into six?
Four into six. I'm sorry.
Four into six because?
Well, I was talking about Gilat Tzion, Simchat Tzion, and I think that's kind of also stated in Gilat Tzion.
Good, and you have Arei Yehuda and Chutzot Yerushalayim, so maybe you'd collapse four and six. You said five and six, why?
Because you've got friends and joy in both five and six.
Yeah, and how about the Chatima, which on six runs on to the next page? What's the Chatima of five versus the Chatima of six? This is like worst nightmares under the chuppah. You like mix them up. Right? Right? They're so close, right? What's number five? Mesameh Chatan. Vikala and Misameach Chatan, Imakala, cue many drashot. But it won't surprise you to know that in some manuscripts of the Talmud, they were exactly the same. Chatan Vikala. Okay? So then if you just have Yotzer Adam number two, Yotzer Adam number three, you've got Chatan Vikala and Chatan Vikala 5, 6, you can already start to collapse those as well. Okay, yeah?
Good question. I've never understood, it was clarified for me in number 3, binyan ade'ad.
Oh. Yeah, binyan ade'ad, right. Vihitkin lo mimenu binyan ade'ad, which is, well, who's the binyan? Okay, so this, now we're already getting to the question of where's Adam and Chava in these brachot? So we already said we have the, Josh already mentioned the Yatzar Adam B'Tzalmo, so you have the Tzelem Elohim there. But now we also have the Binyan Ade'ad, which recalls what part of that story?
Maybe.
Yeah, so there's a Pru'ur Revu, but then you might not use the word Binyan. Who is built in the Adam and Chava story? Chava is built out of Adam.
I see.
Right?
Yeah.
So there is a Binyan Ade'ad, Vihitkin lo mimenu, he established for him, from him, what's the from him? The Tzela, right? Binyan Ade'ad, an eternal binyan, right? This is the eternal connection between Alken Yazov, Ish Etimo, right? Therefore, a person, this is not just an Adam and Chava once in a history, this is the model of everybody.
So does that mean that his and line creation would be capitalized?
In the yes, yeah, exactly. In that reading, that's right. That's right. If you're taking the mimeno as referring to Adam, you could read it another way. You could, you could play around with that. So I think the binyan there is definitely referring to Chava, but you know.
So I just want to put you one more question.
Yeah.
The idea is, I'm not sure binyan, even though we understand what a physical binyan is the right word in English for what you just described.
Okay. Right. I'm just using the language that is used in Breishit.
I'm just saying that. That's
awesome. We all love the Sheva Brachot, right? People love the Sheva Brachot, and when the Rachel Adler translation, it's perfect. But if you want to poke at it, you can find things to poke at, okay? So anyways, now we're sort of noticing, so I would ask you, like, does 3 add to 2 in a significant way? If I was just saying to you, give me the basics, would 2 be enough? Or is 3 adding something significant? So you can play out, okay, maybe the... Again, these are the wedding dress out. Maybe 2 is Yotzer Adam, that's Breishit Aleph. And 3 is, Yotzer Adam and Binyan Ade'ad is Breishit Bet, which is Adam and Chava. I mean, you have both models, Breishit Aleph and Breishit Bet, right? Maybe. I mean, that you could interpret it that way. All I'm saying is that once you have repetition, you're now going to try to figure out, well, why are they repeating it? It could have otherwise just been fine with saying Yotzer Adam. That was like the shortest version of it. Okay? So, and you could go through that and try to slim down and figure out which are the 3 that Eretz Yisrael had. In other words, it's not just an intellectual exercise. There was a sort of significant population of the Jewish people who said, we don't need 6 brachot, we can do 3. Yeah. So 6 is an expansion. Now, I think you had mentioned children, right? When you said in number 4, Mesameach Tzion Bivaneha and Baneha, I was shocked to find this out when I teach this to millennials. They're also still shocked to find out that apparently first comes love, then comes marriage, then comes the baby in the baby carriage. So apparently there is like a direct connection between Adam and Chava's wedding and the population of the human race, right? So there's something that's showing up there where children are going to show up. And I actually think that part of the reason of the structure of these brachot, because again, we asked in my morning shiur, like, early, late, it's fun to identify, and we were always taught, where I learned, that the earlier the better, and late is fair. But I always ask about late. Well, why'd they add? What was wrong with the early, right? So I think there's something about what was 3 and then turned into 6, if you read it in that chronological order, is there something about the multiplicity. That is to say, it's not just repetition. I just said Yotzer Adam. Why am I saying Yotzer Adam again? That is the point of the Adam and Chava model, right? The point is you start with 2 people, and then you expand from there. And the way in which you see it, so again, 1, 2, and 3 could be just Bara Yatzar Yatzar. That's already a threesome of what you could have just said with 1. And 4, 5, and 6, you have Misameach, and Misameach, and Misameach. Right? We got Chatan v'kala, Chatan ima kala, and Tzion bivaneha, but the verb is misamea. So you've got simcha 3 times as well. Right? Yeah.
I want to make sure I understand what you just said. It sounded like you were saying the Sheva Brachot have embedded within them a theme of generativity, So why should the bracha not generate more brachot?
Exactly. Right. No, I'm not gonna stop with three. I'm actually going to be repetitive on purpose because my sort of the message I'm trying to send is this is a moment in which we grow beyond ourselves. Okay? If all you did was have three, then it's like, you know, you're in Yichud forever. Okay? But if you're actually moving beyond and sort of thinking of how things go, yes, it's going to multiply. That's one of the messages of the Adam and Chava story, is that it starts with the couple and then it moves out from there. And that's why it grows. The whole point is to repeat. It's not like, that was a weird textual, you know, incongruity. Okay? This is, again, just to sort of throw out the as I'm arguing, the master narrative here. The master narrative of Adam and Chava, who appear, I think, explicitly in the beginning of the series of brachot, and then sort of as you move through the brachot, you see the result of their union, which is coupling and repeating. Okay? That's if we all we did was Birkat Chatani, I should say, the rabbis had a name for this, which wasn't Sheva Brachot, but in the Mishnah, it's Birkat Chatanim, which, interestingly, as we'll see play out as we look at the Ruth and Boaz, has a parallel, which is not just Birkat Chatanim, but also Birkat Avelim. These, in the list in Mishnah Megillah of all the things you have to say in a minyan, in which there are certain things that are missing, like Kedusha or Kaddish, which hadn't kind of yet been invented, or that's a whole other fight. Okay, they're not in that list, but things that are in the list are Birkat Chatanim and Birkat Avelim, which follow one right on the other. And so there is something to this, what they call Birkat Chatanim, meaning the blessing of the groom, which took place. It's not meant to elide the bride's role, but I'm sure they wouldn't have been opposed to that. But the main focus is this is where the brachot were recited. They were recited in the house of the chatan, as opposed to the birkat erusin, which was recited in the house of the bride or the bride's father. Okay, so birkat chatanim, as they call it, what we call sheva brachot, and birkat avelim, are in some ways parallel, right? You could actually move through that. And although we don't have the text of the Birkat Chatanim of the three brachot that were said in Eretz Yisrael, we do have a text of Birkat Avelim, which comes in the next sugya in Ketubot, and also come in the Tosefta. And you can just sort of check it out. You know, what would they say when they had a funeral? What were these brachot that you would say after burying the dead? That are in some ways parallel to the same thing that you're doing at the beginning of life. That is to say, Birkat Avelim is marking the end of life, and the wedding is really marking the beginning of life. Okay, and that's the Adam and Chava model. Now you can love it, you can hate it, you can poke at it, you can say it's not for me or whatever you want. What I'm trying to argue now is that that's not the only model of the wedding that they're putting out there. There's another model that's hiding. Maybe in plain sight, we're going to try to bring it up to plain sight, and that's the model of Ruth and Boaz. And in order for us to sort of get into that, what I'm going to invite us to do is to spend a little bit of time looking at the fourth chapter of Ruth, which I know is review, but I think it's nice to, first of all, read it when you're not exhausted, having gone through whatever your Shavuot experience is. And sometimes, like the fourth chapter of the book of Ruth, it's like past the headline, you know, quotes. The exciting first two chapters, and just this, it's sort of like the coda, but for our purposes, it's actually the main event. That is to say, it's one of the longest descriptions, maybe the longest description, of a wedding that takes place in the Bible. We get to hear how it all happens, okay? And what I'd like you to do, as you're going to turn to Chavruta and just read chapter 4 of Ruth, which starts on page 2 and runs through page 3, and maybe one line on page 4, what is the difference? Or what are the differences between the wedding that goes on with Ruth and Boaz versus a standard wedding? Now, a standard wedding could be the wedding I did last week, or it could be Adam and Chava, or it could be, I don't know, any other wedding ever. How is it different here? Okay? What's the difference between what's the unique features of the wedding of Ruth and Boaz versus other weddings? That's what I'm asking us to do, to think about as we read chapter 4 of Ruth. So we're going to take about 20 minutes or so to just read the fourth chapter of Ruth. Turn to a neighbor or friend. What's unique? Okay, let's bring it back together here. I will be curious to hear from you what you notice that's unique or different about this wedding than other weddings. Just to remind us, this is in the beginning of the Book of Ruth, just so that we can remind ourselves of the situation. These characters reappear in chapter 4, but just to remind ourselves, Elimelech and Naomi are married, and then they head off because of famine to Moab, and when they get to Moab, Elimelech dies. And then Naomi is left with her two children named Mahlon and Chilion. Pro tip, don't name your kids Mahlon and Chilion. Okay? Don't name them Hevel. All right, we've been through this. Okay? Mahlon marries Ruth, and which isn't clear in chapter 1, but it's clear in chapter 4. Mahlon marries Ruth, and Chilion marries Orpah. And then Mahlon and Chilion, shocker, die. And then you've got the only people left are, right? Naomi, Orpah, and Ruth. And, of course, Orpah turns her Oref back to Naomi, turns her neck back to Naomi, and even though goes halfway but doesn't complete it, and Ruth in the famous scene follows Naomi back. And now we're picking up at the end of the story, after the encounter with Boaz and the threshing floor and the gleaning and all the stuff. What is unique about the wedding scene here? What are some unique features that come out? Yeah, please.
How Boaz presents the information to the Redeemer, sort of leading him into being able to actualize taking the role of the Redeemer to begin.
Okay, so first of all, even just to step back from the presentation from Boaz to the Redeemer, we have in this wedding two possible grooms, right? Which is not normally like, are you inviting the former boyfriend to the wedding? I don't know, right? Now you're allowed to, millennials, okay. But right, so there's another path here, which I think is significant, and the path is considered seriously, right? And he actually says, yes, I'm ready to do this, until he realizes that it comes with the package deal, includes Ruth, and then he says, I'd rather not, right? Okay? And it's just worth stating out loud is that this is not a normal wedding, also in the sense that both the Ploni Almoni and Boaz are both playing the role of Goel, which is, that is to say, what are they Goeling?
Land.
The first husband.
The first husband and the land that would come with him, right? Which is to say, Mahlon is hanging out there in the background. Okay, that there is another presence, another person, a first love, a first connection that is trying to be restored, and that is the role of Boaz. So this is not a standard romance. Again, contrasting with Adam and Eve, for Chava, you know, looking around, it's like, well, I got the giraffe and I got Adam, okay, so I'm going to go with Adam. I mean, if you look at Genesis 2, it actually works that way with Adam and, well, I tried the animals, that didn't quite work, so let's go with Chava, okay? So, you know, there's really no other choice in the Adam and Chava model, but in the Boaz and Ruth model, it's not only is there another option, the anonymous other plan, but also both of them are stepping into a former past of Ruth, that they are trying to redeem. That is the function of them and this marriage. Okay, other things that you noticed, yeah.
I have a question.
Yeah.
We're talking about this as if it's the wedding, but my question is is verse 13 a summary or is verse 13 a continuation?
Yeah, okay, so verse 13 is when, and it's translated here in the, this is JPS translation, but Vaikach Boaz et Ruth is translated Vaitilo Li'isha, so Boaz married Ruth, she became his wife. Vayikach is more, you know, I mean, that might be the biblical way you say marry, but is that he took her. Vayikach Boaz at Ruth, which again, it's not a violent image particularly, it's just how they said it. But that is, I think that is the wedding, right? That is the moment of the marriage.
So then what happens before is like the engagement party, like, because you're presenting like essentially the redemption ceremony as the wedding, but it's not.
Good. Okay, right. In that, it's the tish, right? It's the, you know, let's get all the business out of the way here, and then we're gonna move to the wedding ceremony, which seems to happen in that in that moment, they do get blessed. Well, just look at verse 11 for a second, right? Vayemru kol ha'am asher bashar v'azkenim edim yitein Adonai et ha'isha ba'a el beitecha ki Rachel u'kilea asher banu shteyem et beit Yisrael. Right? You do have this blessing that comes from the people. Here it's not from the officiant, as it were. This is sort of like the grassroots blessing that comes. And who are they meant to be like? Ki Rachel v'lea asher banu shteyem et beit Yisrael. So here you have a different binyan ade'ad. Right? There, the binyan ha-de'ad that we have in our Sheva Brachot, I'm calling Sheva Birkat Chatanim, is the Adam and Chava model. But here, Rachel and Leah are sort of called upon, at least in the people's blessing, as the ones who built at Beit Yisrael. And that's also, so like, where is the moment of the marriage? Is it the blessing? Is it the moment of taking? It's all happening in the same day, as it were.
Because if we're talking about this as the wedding ceremony, but they don't get, they're not married until after, then...
Right. Well, also, what's the consummation of our, you know, our wedding also doesn't consummate in the moment of the blessings, which happen afterwards at Yichud. But yes, I hear your point. There's a preamble here that we don't often associate with our blessings. Yeah, Ted.
It seems like the wedding itself is a communal blessing at the gate with the elders and the witnesses and everybody there.
Good.
Whereas halachic marriage is a contract between the two people.
Okay.
This is a communal offering.
Yeah, good. So you're noticing there is a heavy, heavy participation of community here, which starts off at the beginning. How does the preamble start? What does Boaz do to convene the situation? What does he say? Yeah, in verse 2. He takes twice, right? He takes her, but before that he takes the 10 men, Mizignei Ha'ir, and says, you sit here. And that's the sort of beginning, and that's, they are sort of constituting the community, and then we have the blessing of the whole community, the whole city is giving that blessing. So that is also different. Now we know the way Rashi reads the first blessing in Birkat Chatanim, in the Sheva Brachot, Shakol Bar Alich Vodo, is, you know, in honor of the communal masses who are there. Hakol. Right? If you look at the Rashi in Ketubot, it says, well, that's, we have to have, start off with a blessing for everybody who came. So maybe it's also an at least Rashi's read of those brachot is that there is a, you know, a group of people who are always going to be at the wedding. But yes, this is much more communal than other imagined weddings that we might have as the standard meet, as the standard line that we're comparing this to. Do you want to add, Adam?
Sure. Just to reinforce the point, it seems like the focus, the lens, is not on the couple. Here's the thing. So who gets the blessing? Verse 14. Naomi gets blessed, not Ruth.
Yeah.
Right. And then it says in verse 17. It's amazing. Yulad ben the Naomi. Right. I mean, yeah. What? It's crazy.
Yeah. And I would say what's even crazier is, so you'll notice right after the wedding, as it were, the taking in verse 13, Ruth is gone, right?
Yeah.
She is gone, and actually the purpose of this wedding becomes very clear, which is not even really to restore Mahlon's name, but to restore Naomi's name, right? And Naomi herself, in the verse before the Yulad Ben LeNaomi, why does she get to be called the mother of the child? Because in verse 16, Vatihi lo Leomenet, which they translate here as, what is it?
Foster
mother, but that's a nice euphemism for wet nurse.
Yes.
Naomi is, you know, suckling the baby. She's nursing. This is the same language that's used with Yocheved and Moshe as a bit, right? So this is a miracle that takes place. Naomi is, not only is her line restored through the children that happen here with putting in Boaz, right, and the line that ends with David, which we'll have to in a second, but also Naomi is restored to the woman who herself could give sustenance to new life, which is an incredible miracle that we also like blow through at the end of chapter 4. But your point of like who are the main characters of this wedding, they're just sort of highlighting it here, is that the child is Naomi, and it sort of runs through that. Okay, other things that you notice here? Yeah.
We don't even know if Ruth is actually present.
Yeah.
Right, she may not even be there for the whole ceremony itself, right? Which is, you know, the kinyan aspect that's sort of set up in the beginning, and she's, you know, part of the land that's, you know, that's being, the estate that's being taken over. She may or may not be there. We'll see the rabbinic understanding of that in a second. Yeah.
Yeah. Just looking at the blessing that the Zkenim offer, it's sort of presented as being spontaneous, but it has a formulaic appeal to it.
Uh-huh.
Like, are there any thoughts on this?
In verse 11, is that what you're saying?
Liturgical.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's interesting.
What they're supposed to say.
Yeah.
Right?
It's interesting because when you take verse 11 and you sort of follow it through, where does this ever have any liturgical reappearance in our own liturgical cycle? So the blessing that's offered for children on Friday night, Yisimcha Elohim Kefraim Bichim Nashe, is a quote from the Torah, but Yisimech Elohim Kesar Rivka Rachel Veleya is actually an invented liturgy that doesn't show up in the Torah at all. But the pre-blessing for that, meaning the idea of blessing your children, actually starts off as, bless your children, fill in the blank. Like, it's like the moment in CPE where they tell you to pray with the patient. You're like, what page? You know? And it's like, no page, people, okay? So it's like, bless your children originally was, yeah, give a blessing to your children. What blessing? I don't know. They're your children. You make it up, okay? And then it moves from there to, they actually quote this line, right, of Rachel and Leah, and then that moves to Sarah, Rivka, Rachel and Leah, sort of becomes sort of parallel-ish to Ephraim and Menashe. But yes, it does have this feel of a liturgy that's being spoken, even though it's like the first time it's ever been said, presumably. Yeah, please.
It just sounds like
Well, I think what's true about that is in this situation, I would say yes, and it's not just any mother-in-law, but it's the mother-in-law who is experiencing all this loss, right? It's the person who, if I told you, what do they say when Naomi comes back to Beit Lechem after return, right? Could it be Hazot Naomi? Could this be Naomi? She is destroyed. Everything about her is ruined. She has no more family. Her two sons died. Her husband died. There's no chance for her ever being restored. And yet, the miracle is she is restored. It is about her because she is the most impossible character to imagine ever coming through the other end of this tragedy. And there she is at the end of chapter 4, suckling a baby she never should have had and never doesn't have the ability to do that, but she's doing it. So yes, twinning it with Adam's point, it is about her. Please.
Why are you saying that she is the most, that she gets redeemed, Naomi, and that Ruth, what about her?
Okay, so I want to come back to Ruth because Ruth is, of course, and sort of in our imagination. Sorry?
Who's
going to
redeem her?
Who's going to redeem Ruth? Right,
yeah.
Right. Well, Ruth, of course, gets to be also, miraculously, the mother of David, right? Which so many of us are into this idea, right? Of David comes through, and by the way, it's not just David who shows up here, but who is the other, if Ruth is a forbidden woman, who's the other forbidden woman that's hiding out in chapter 4? Tamar, right? Because the line starts with, not with who should it have started with. You're tracing back the line of David, where do you start? What's that?
Yehuda.
That's where they start with parents, but who should you have started with? Yehuda, right? Let's start with Yehuda, parents' father, or you can start with Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov.
If you don't want to forget.
Yeah, right, exactly. So you have two forbidden unions here. And Edom was reminding me that his dad was speaking about this, how the union of Tamar and Yehuda produces a mamzer, right? Where Yehuda has relations with his kala, with his daughter-in-law, which is forbidden, and their offspring is Peretz, and what's his brother's name? You remember?
Zerah,
right?
Zerah.
And why is he called Peretz? Yeah. What does Peretz mean? He broke through, right? He broke through with his, this is like, if you've been in the delivery room, imagine this scene, right? The twin, first one, sticks out his hand, and they're like, let's tie a red string here, take him to the kotel, and then he pulls that back, and then out comes Zerach, right? So he is the paratza, ma paratza lecha peretz. He sort of punches his way through, okay? Which is to say, He is not the expected firstborn. He's an unexpected child. And there he is sort of breaking through. And that's the union of Tamar and Yehuda. And then it sort of gets heightened with the union, meaning Ruth still stays there as this is an unusual union that also should have produced, shouldn't have happened, and should have produced nothing, but ends up producing David, which is, of course, one of the major redemptive themes of the story. Yeah.
Are you saying that the way she gets redeemed is by her
offspring? Yeah. She becomes the most unlikely. You're not supposed to marry a Moabiyah. Okay, you want Moabiyah. But you're not supposed to marry them, basically. And here they are giving us birth, and they're just following in the family tradition of forbidden unions that produce, and where do we call Peretz? We know that Peretz is the father of the Messiah. We say it in the Chanodi. Where do we say it?
Ben Partzi.
Al Yadish Ben Partzi, right? And by the way, how many generations from Peretz to David? If you're gonna guess, 10. You know what the Kabbalists like? They love 10. All right, check it out. L'chadodi, 9 verses plus l'chad. Okay, and we'll go down. Okay, Elliot.
Just to build on that point, that you got to remember where Moab comes from.
That's right.
Yeah.
An ancestral union at the very beginning.
Good.
So there's a progression from. It starts with X-rated. And then it goes to kind of R-rated, and by the time you get to Boaz and Ruth, it's sort of a G-rated, so the line ultimately brings us to the Mashiach.
Yeah.
So that's number one. So I think that, and I just didn't want to lose some in the blue, I'm sorry, I don't know.
Amy.
Amy, about the mother-in-law and daughter-in-law, that this one verse to be lost about, you know, that a good daughter-in-law is much better than two dead sons, or your two dead sons.
Right.
Or seven.
I am to you, she is better to you than seven sons, which sounds like what?
Hannah. I mean,
that's right.
Right. And so this word of, you know, nefemta that is being spoken here, but I'm wondering, you know, how that sounds when the women gather around Naomi and Naomi's mind. You know, like, kind of like, are you kidding me?
Right.
Hearing it as, so this daughter-in-law versus dead son's question is, I think, just hanging there unanswered.
Right. It is interesting, you know, Ruth could be like, you know, this is great. You take the kid. I'm going off with Boaz. We'll see you next week, right? You know, it's like there is a love story between Ruth and Boaz that doesn't go away. And the chesed that Boaz says that Ruth does for him is very present. In that way, it is sort of the romance story, even though it sort of precedes romance.
Why isn't this child, anyway, shouldn't it be the child of Elimelech?
But that's right. Yeah. Elimelech, well, it's interesting why Elimelech, he talk about somebody who really disappears, yeah. Right? He really does. His main function in the story, besides marrying Naomi, is leaving town.
But the whole thing is that he's supposed to be maintaining the line
that Boaz is continuing Elimelech's line.
Actually the line of
Mahla.
Right. No, yes. This is, normally you would have, like, in the sort of levirate marriage situation, you don't care about these people up here, you only have here. I'm saying that Naomi becomes a significant character because she's so unlikely to ever resurface. It is a triat hametim of Naomi. Now, what I want, Sue, do you want? Yeah.
Two things.
Please.
One is just linguistically, just going back to your question about elements that appear.
Yeah.
Don't appear. So just to mention, maybe too technical for some people, but there's two mentions of kinyan, of the verb kinyan.
Yeah.
And there is also the verb built up in the context of
Asher Banu, right.
So I just want to...
Good, so there's Kinyan and there's Binyan and they're both showing up here. And you want to add?
Well, the larger thing I want to say, which does not work in any way chronologically, and I don't know what to make of it, but yet I want to acknowledge that as one can be struck by one's own ideas. When you were talking about Naomi, utterly destroyed, can this be Naomi returning, the image of her nursing? I really started thinking of this as like an anti-Echa, like that this is the rebuilding of that which has been utterly destroyed. You think about the images of suckling mothers in Echa and how devastating that is, and Echa, but I mean, I don't know.
It
doesn't work at all temporally, but the resonance is for me there.
Yeah, and the rejoicing we saw in the Sheva Brachot, again, the master narrative of the Sheva Brachot of these the children that are rejoicing, you know, right now the city is destroyed, but there is a vision in which the children come back, a sort of a restoration. Okay, so I want to move on and just try to understand. All we've done so far is put out two models. One is Adam and Chava, which I'm arguing to come from the Sheva Brachot, or really more technically Birkat Chatanim, that's in the Gemara, Rav Yehuda's liturgy. And then we looked at chapter 4 of Ruth and saw this is a different, whatever that was, this is different, okay? And now what I want to try to do is tie chapter 4 to the wedding ritual that we have today. That is to say, it's not just hanging out in the Bible, is my contention. It is a sub-narrative in the normal wedding ritual. And I want to bring to you three points of evidence in which this comes out. Again, I think it's hiding maybe in plain sight about where Ruth and Naomi is showing up in our standard wedding liturgy, and then you'll tell me what you think sticks and what doesn't stick. Okay, so the first and probably easiest proof of this is if you flip over to page 4, is on the page before the Sheva Brachot in Masechet Ketubot, you have the question. So as I said, the Mishnah in Megillah says that one of the things that you have to have with 10 is Birkat Chatanim. And then the Gemara asks, in text number 3 on page 4, Minayin le Birkat Chatanim Basara? What's the scriptural proof that you have to have Birkat Chatanim, that you have to have what we call Sheva Brachot with a minyan, with 10? Sheneemar, proof text, Vayikach Asara Anashim Mizignei Ha'ir, Vayomer Shivu Po. That this is the moment at the beginning, the preamble of the wedding, but the start of the wedding, as I'm calling it, with Boaz, is Boaz calling the ten men to sit and witness. And what are they witnessing when they get called? What's the real purpose of their witnessing? The chalitza, right? The first potential suitor who rejects the whole thing, and they're just the witnesses watching this whole thing unfold. Okay, but it ends up being, meaning, if you were just reading Ruth, you wouldn't necessarily say, oh yeah, from Ruth I understand you need a minyan for a wedding. But the way the Gemara reads it is, of course, that was the start of the whole thing. Birkat Chatanim begins when Boaz calls upon those 10 people to show up. So I'm saying right here in the Gemara, you have sort of explicitly, there is Boaz and Ruth showing up. I'd say it's not because, I mean, how many people showed up at Adam and Chava's wedding? I mean, there was the giraffe. There was also, right, who's the groomsman? God, right? It was smaller then, you know. Save money. Okay. So that's sort of point one. Floating out there in the Gemara is that Boaz and Ruth are the source of why we need a minyan for what we call Sheva Brachot. Okay. Yeah.
Before you go off there. Why does it say that it's a custom to bless them 7 blessings, even a widow or a woman's widow, because of the resonance with them?
Okay, so now I'm going to the second part, which is, okay, so now moving. First piece of evidence is text number 3, just straight up from the Gemara and Ketubot. The reason you need a minyan is because of Boaz and Ruth. Okay, they're bringing Boaz and Ruth into the standard wedding. Every wedding, not just chalitza, not just this special wedding. All weddings need asara. All birkat chatanim needs asara, and we're taking that from it. Now, the second one, this is a great set of texts from Or Chor Chaim, Sefer Kolbo, which the debate about how they're related, but they're definitely related. Either they're the same person or it was like shockingly plagiaristic. But they're hanging out in the Middle Ages, and they bring this amazing piece of reporting from the field that there was a different set of blessings, really a different blessing that said in a particular circumstance, okay? And this is the blessing that they say that you're supposed to have when a widow marries a widower, okay? And then they say, and this is a great like word to the wise, and then they say at the end, and I just reported this to you, but don't do it. But it's like, by reporting, the only evidence we have of it is the person who told us not to do it. So maybe if he hadn't said anything, it would have actually gone into oblivion. But yeah.
You're saying this is an alternative text to the Sheva Brachot?
Yes.
And then it says, but we don't.
We're going to read it and see, okay? So first of all, just look. Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam, Borei Pri HaGafen, that's the Rosh Tevot, that's the abbreviation in the beginning. Then we have, this is instead of all the Birkat Chatanim that we say, instead of Sheva Brachot that we say, alternative text, one bracha for widow and widower, which goes like this. Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam, Hama'atirchem Ateret Simcha Ki'ateret Boaz bebeit lechem. Asher birchu oto kol kahal Yisrael. We saw that bracha that all the people of Israel blessed them. Va'edim he'idu alav edud ne'emana. And they say in that ceremony, we are edim. Right? So just recalling the end of chapter 4 of Ruth. Kakatu, Vayamru kolam asher bashar v'gomer. Right? And then they actually quote the verse, which is interesting because there's a whole line of scholarship in liturgy which thinks that all liturgy actually had straight up quotes from Tanakh as the end of it. Like, which we know from Kedusha. Like, Kakatu, b'divrei kochecha, or v'ne'emar, right? The end of Aleinu, okay? Which is really just taken from the...
Have
Yirmiyahu quoted, right? The last bracha is Yirmiyahu, right, exactly. So, but it doesn't say it explicitly, Shene'emar, Kakatuv, but this bracha might be a version of that old style liturgy, where it's not just I make up the liturgy, I always am grounding it with a direct quote from the Bible. But here it is, they're quoting Boaz. And then the bracha, the chatima, is Baruch Ata Hashem, Matzliach Ish V'Isha. Ish V'Isha should be successful, should have atzlacha. Okay? That's what it is. But now, V'Aminah Yachshav, Levarech Lehem Sheva Brachot, Afilu La'amon, Shenasa Almana. Okay, but now we don't have the minhag to do that anymore. But he's reporting an old minhag that we had. Okay? So the second piece of evidence that I'm putting on the table is that there was an old practice to note the difference between what is the status of the people who are getting married. Why might the almon, they call it almon, we call it alman, why would the widower and the widow not want to use the standard liturgy of Birkat Chatanim, of Sheva Brachot?
Can I ask you?
Because they're post-kid?
Yeah. Yeah, right. So either because they're post-kid, which is like the whole thing that's oriented around the...
Or they're biologically, they can't have children.
Right, so maybe they're, it's just impossible for them to have it, or what?
They lost their partner. It didn't work.
It doesn't, right? The Ottoman Chava model didn't work for them because they went through this once before. Right? That is to say, not all weddings are the same. And when you think about Adam and Chava as the narrative of Adam and Chava is, by definition, beginning. That is to say, part of the reason there were no wedding guests is there's no parents, there's no mother-in-law, there's no anybody, right? It's just them. That is to say, they're the beginning of the world. And so when you're standing under the chuppah, at least for the first three brachot, as you're really delving into that story, you are stepping into the role of, we are the first couple. No one else ever could be out there for me. It's, I only have eyes for you as if you're the only one in the world, right? That's, and yet, for someone who has already been married and widowed, becomes a widow or widower, it's just, that's not reality, right? And so I've got to come up with another model. And behold, there is another model, right? And it's Boaz and Ruth. And I'm going to write you a whole new bracha that's going to explicitly quote them, going to make up a whole new chatima, a whole new end of the bracha that says, Matzliach ish v'isha, not chatan v'kala. I've been down the chatan v'kala road before. Now I'm in ish v'isha, which you want to say is more, equal, maybe? It's using the same words, but that's another model that's floating out there.
It's derivative from the prophet, who said, you will no longer call me Baal, but
an ish, right, exactly, right. It's sort of the next step in the relationship, perhaps, and if you read it in light of that evolving relationship where Baal means master and Ish seems to have some more, egalitarian, relationship, maybe you could read that into these words. Yes?
So, help me understand something. You refer to this originally as a sub-narrative embedded in the Sheva Brachot,
mm-hmm.
but this presentation seems to suggest that Dafka, the Sheva Brachot that we have, are wholly... Dafka do not refer to Boaz and Ruth, and anything that resembles Boaz and Ruth needs a different way to phrase it.
Right.
To me, it's almost the opposite. So I need to hear more from you to understand.
So I would say that, again, when you're imagining a world in which they're recognizing that one bracha doesn't fit all, okay? So I have an option to solve that problem, which is, by the way, not an option that the Babylonians are ever into, which is, I'm saying Babylonian, anyone who believes in the Babylonian Talmud as authoritative, The folks who brought you the Babylonian Talmud, the Gaonim, who were hanging out in Iraq, you know, after the close of the Talmud, closed the Talmud for us, also said, if it's not written in the Talmud, don't say it, vis-a-vis brachot. But guess what? In Eretz Yisrael, you want to write a new bracha? Geg is unto hate, right? Just when they opened up the Geniza, they found hundreds and hundreds of brachot that were just not standard. And each time the Babylonians find out about these brachot, they go crazy, you know, and say, don't say that, it's not in the Talmud. But there were other Jews who were like, you know, living out these alternative lives, of liturgical lives, where they're writing new stuff all the time, including new brachot. And maybe this is coming from that idea that you have a new situation, you want to write something new, so it's there. Now, in the end, Or Chor Chaim, who's living post the end of Eretz Yisrael Minhag and liturgy, says, well, we don't do that anymore. And yeah, we have a one-size-fits-all blessing. But what I'm saying is there's something floating around of a recognition that it's not all there in that blessing, even if we're just using that blessing now. So I'm not saying, now go home and do this bracha for the widow and the widower. But what I'm saying is that there is a recognition that there's something floating around underneath that got subterraneized. That's not a word, but you know, it sort of got pushed down, but is now being sort of surfaced a little bit as well. And Ted, you want to say?
Yeah, just and one of the major historical questions is at what time, or how long it took for real rabbinic Judaism, for the rabbis to have authority over what was going on among the people and in the synagogues, both in Babel and there in Israel. I mean, that is a major question.
Yes, true. Right. Yeah, exactly. Right. There's a long debate about when did rabbis actually gain any foothold in the Beit Knesset, which was
any day now.
Right. Any day now. Exactly. Right. It's who's voting on the contract? This was going back. I mean, yes, it's a problem. But I think what you're seeing here is that even with rabbinic authority, there was another strand of Jewish history that was totally fine with liturgical creation. And, people who were writing poems, like the Piyutim, they were not just amcha. They were very knowledgeable, what we would call rabbis, who were, that was their whole deal, was to write new liturgy. What do you mean I'm not going to write new liturgy? Now, I think somebody was sort of hinting to say, well, wait a minute, I understand, who is the widow and the widower in this, in our story? Who? Right. So we know that Ruth is a widow, but what about Boaz? This is the first time I'm learning that Boaz is a widower, right? Now, it doesn't say that in the pshat. If you just read through the story of Ruth, Boaz seems to be, actually the chesed seems to be, that he is an elderly person, and though Ruth could have done better for herself in his eyes, she is nevertheless going to stick with him, but it doesn't say that he has a past, a sort of a love past. But the Midrash doesn't understand it that way. The Midrash understands Boaz to be a widower himself, and I just wanted to look at the way in which they figured this out. So look over on page 5. Okay, so in the second paragraph on page 5 from the Yerushalmi, this Midrash comes a few different places. We'll just look at the Yerushalmi. Rabbi Lazer, Bei Rabbi Yossi, says, from here we learn that the groom's blessing is with 10. They're talking again about Boaz, the pasuk we saw before. Now Rabbi Yehuda Bar Pazi says, and this matter doesn't end with the marriage of a young man and a young woman, but even a widower to a widower, so to a widow, we learn from Boaz, since he was a widower and Ruth was a widow. Now, I know Ruth was a widow, but how do I know that Boaz was a widower? And it's written, here's the proof. And it's written, the whole town was shocked concerning them. Vateom kol ha'ir aleihem. Who's the aleihem in that verse? Who are they shocked about? Naomi and Ruth, right? And they said, right? Can this be? And the women said, Hazot Naomi. Could this be Naomi? Now, what's the interpretative problem of that pasuk?
It doesn't prove anything.
Okay, well, hold on. Doesn't prove anything is already before the Midrash. Let's get to the Midrash. What is the Midrash trying to understand that's problematic with the pasuk?
Who's Naomi that they would be all worked up
about? Okay, right. How do they know Naomi is someone to be worked up about? And also, just again, like we say on Seder night, what's the Midrash on Seder night from Ben Zoma and the Chachamim?
Yeah.
Right?
Or any convention.
Yeah, until I understand that it was right. Okay. Yeah, what's the word that they're drushing there?
Kol.
Kol yamei chayecha. Could have just said yamei chayecha. Kol yamei chayecha. So what's the problem in this pasuk? Batahom kol ha'ir. What do you mean kol ha'ir? The whole city saw them when you showed up in Manhattan. Did everybody in Manhattan show up and greet you at you know, Penn Station? No. We're a very friendly city, okay? Safest large city in America, just saying, okay? So, Batam Kolayer, how is it possible that the whole city showed up when Naomi crossed the threshold back into Beit Lechem? What's the answer? Ve'efshar kein kol karta mitbala begin Naomi ala libata? Is it possible that the whole city showed up? And the answer is, yes. Why? El ishto shel Boaz meta be'oto hayom. The wife of Boaz died on the very day that Naomi was coming back with Ruth. And where did they see them? They crossed at the entrance to the city. Why was the whole city leaving? The burial is outside the city. And Boaz is a big shot, and everybody's going to the funeral. And so the whole city is there as they're coming in. Okay? And as a result, and this is, I think, the kicker of the Midrash, Nichneset Rut im Naomi, V'nimtza zo yotzeit, V'zo nichneset. Right? We find in this moment that as this one is going out, this one is coming in. That is to say, the moment of the tragedy and the death and the loss is also the moment, the seed of the beginning and the redemption. Right? Which is a totally different understanding of loss. You would never comfort someone by saying, well, don't worry. Actually, on the day your wife died, your next wife was you just met her, right? But there is some sort of theological approach here, which is to say, there is a redemptive possibility that starts in loss. Or to put it in another way, I can't be redeemed unless I experience loss, right? Adam and Chava, actually, at the moment of their wedding, there's no loss. They're at the beginning. They haven't eaten the apple. Now, according to the Midrash, not an apple. They haven't. According to the Midrash, it's like a couple hours they have right before they sin and fall, and then they leave Eden. And the whole thing of Geula is, and the way Jews talk about redemption is, not to go to a new place we've never seen before, but to go back to the place where we started, right? Which is the same thing about land, right? The goel in the land, in the Yovel situation, is you're just returning land to where it started. Everything redemption is about going back to the original state. Okay? But when Adam and Chava get married, everything is perfect. It's the perfect moment for them. That's not how all people experience relationship. Yeah.
How do we know that they were married before the fall? Because we have the I'm just trying to figure out, is that midrashic or is that...
No, when you read the... Well, first of all, in the first parak, they seem to get together and there seem to be one union anyways. In the second parak, they're also... They connect to each other first, and then the snake shows up right afterwards. But the...
Well, they know God was the Masada condition. It's very clear. Right. But there was no minions. So.
There's no minions, so it's right. It's a questionable union.
Ten
spheres. Okay. So we've got two pieces of evidence. One piece of evidence is you need a minion because of Boaz and Ruth. Second piece of evidence is there was another bracha that was buried in halachic literature that was written explicitly for widows and widowers. That is to say, people were non-standard, non-Adam and Chava couples who experienced loss. And noticing, and I think I want to metaphorize the possibility of taking widow and widower not just as literally losing a spouse, but any form of loss and suffering, right? What do you come to the wedding with? What is the baggage that you're bringing? What's the loss and the suffering that you're coming with? Whether it is a relationship or any other kind of thing, where Ruth and Boaz are also modeling that. And it's not just Ruth who has the loss, which is the pshat of the Tanakh, but also Boaz lost. And in the moment of his loss, was found the seeds of the redemption, okay? That's two pieces of evidence. My third piece of evidence that I'm going to put out in our last few minutes together is a very unusual reference in the Gemara that's hard to understand, but when you sort of connect it to Ruth and Boaz, it seems obvious to me. So just turn over to page 6. The Gemara in the same section of Ketubot that brings us to Sheva Brachot asks the following question. When are you allowed to say, from when do we start saying the special zimun, the special Birkat HaMazon that you say after a wedding takes place, which goes what? Shal simcha b'mona. Right? V'shal chal l'mishal. So you add two special words, simcha, like misameach chatan v'kala, shal simcha b'mona. How early can you start saying that special Birkat HaMazon is the question of the Gemara. And the answer that we have from Rav Papa is, from the time they throw barley in the mortar. Got it. Okay, right? Classic Talmud, all right? Those guys are making it easier. Now the question is, well, what does it mean to throw barley into the mortar? Okay, so Rashi explains for us, they soak the barley in a water trough in order to raise money for the cost of the wedding. That is to say, whatever it is, weddings were expensive, always were expensive, and now we got to sort of, you know, sell some lemonade on the corner in order to raise the money for the wedding. And that when you're already raising money for the wedding, it's happening. Okay, like when you put the down payment, you know, when you write that first check, the wedding is happening. You can already start saying Shasimcha b'mono. That's to say, they're advancing it before the actual ceremony, which is interesting in of itself. But then he says, and there are those who say that for the sake of the bride. And by the way, what are you making why is barley in a water trough valuable?
Beer,
right? That's you're gonna have your. I know, in our wedding they didn't drink, but okay. And there are those who say that for the sake of the bride and groom, they sow barley in a flower pot to say, "Pru uruvu, be fruitful, multiply, and flower like this barley." Now we know this from our own movie wedding culture. What happens at a wedding when they're running down the steps of the church?
Rice.
Why is it rice? Because it doesn't stain the wedding dress. No. Why is it rice? Why do we throw rice at a wedding?
Because it expands when it gets in.
Yeah, there's a lot of it, and it grows, right? And you know why we proverbially throw barley in a Jewish wedding? Where's barley in the cycle of the agriculture? We're headed down to that season. It's first, right? Right after Pesach, the first harvest is the barley harvest. It's the peretz of agriculture, right? It's the punch through. I'm gonna sprout first, right? You bring the wheat later. That's on Shavuot, but on Pesach you already started to count the Omer. Barley is first, okay? So Rashi's explaining to us that when are we allowed to start noticing this as a couple? When can we say Shasimcha b'mono? When we're already getting our first wedding gift from Bed Bath & Beyond, which is a flower pot filled with barley seeds, which is wink, wink, and the mother-in-law is into this, and so is the father-in-law. Let's start having, you know, get ready for the baby room, etc. That's where Rashi's drawing us towards, okay? Now, how does that relate to Ruth? What's that?
There's no
Kanahara here. It's pretty subtle, you know, okay? I'm not buying you the crib. I'm just giving you a plant, and it's going to sprout pretty soon. Now, how does this relate back to Ruth? It's the barley harvest, right? Why does root happen in the barley harvest? It is foreshadowed. Look at verse, the next one, source 11. Root chapter 1, verse 22. Okay, they return back from Moab. They arrived in Bethlehem, b'tchilat k'tzir so'rim. When do they arrive? What's tchilat k'tzir so'rim? Pesach. That's when they're showing up, at the beginning of the barley harvest. Now I'm saying to you, is it just random that they're throwing in that detail? Is it like, well, it's nice to know. When did they show up? So I can sort of imagine it. I'm telling you, when the barley shows, it's like when the gun is in the first scene, you know someone's going to get, when the barley's in the first chapter, you know there's going to be a baby at the end. Okay, that's the way it works, which is to say, Zoyotzeit v'zonichneset. It's not just total midrashic fantasy. When they come into the city, there's already a hint that there's going to be a new seed that's planting, that's sprouting. Yeah.
And also, just going back to the very beginning, they left in famine, they're coming back to something that's a symbol for abundance.
Good, right? From famine to abundance. And of course, the encounter between Ruth and Boaz takes place on the
barley tree.
Right, exactly, right? Hine zorera gorena sorima laila. What's Boaz doing when she goes and pays him a late night visit? Swipe right?
And talk about it.
Right? He's winnowing the barley.
Wink, wink.
As it were. Okay? Right? And this plays out, right? And you know, And he says, this is a strange thing that happens in the, like you would miss it. You're already asleep at this point. But it's like chapter 3. And he said, hold out the shawl you are wearing. She held it out while he measured out 6 measures of barley. And he put it back on her back. He is giving her barley. Okay? We know when he gives her barley, Naomi's going to have a child. It's the throwing of the rice. It's the zoyotzeg v'zonichneset. It's something that I, even though I'm suffering, the marriage hasn't even, it's not even begun, I'm already willing to say that something is going to sprout here. And that's a totally different orientation than Adam and Chava is what I'm saying. Meaning it's surprising. You wouldn't expect, here are some people who never thought, Naomi, Boaz, Ruth, none of them expected to harvest anything else. Right? And what they harvest in the end is Mashiach. That's where it ends. Because you can only be redeemed if you lose. Okay? Only through loss can you be redeemed. So I want to put this out there as 3 pieces of evidence that there is a sub-narrative to our wedding ritual that is also about where you go from loss. And that's something that we might be able to bring into our own lives as we consider what does it mean to show up at a wedding having carried stuff with us all the way. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. To learn more with Hadar, please visit hadar.org/Torah.